This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Stories for you from the April 2012 issue of Looking Back magazine. We're starting today's program with a letter from the editor, the editor's letter. The all-American boy face with that look of determination makes me think of my brother, or rather, all three of my brothers. They all played baseball at one point or another in their school days, and oh, how they loved the sport. My dad was a baseball fan too, and when spring arrived, it was time for all four of them to pay attention to the game once again. The radio in the kitchen would crackle with news of spring training. The boys would get their gloves oiled and ready, and my dad would fire up his orange Alice Chalmers tractor, hitch an old rusty bed spring behind it, and start dragging it around our homemade baseball diamond in the back lot, working up the dirt clods that winter had left behind. How lucky we were to have one of those magical places in our very own backyard. We lived on the edge of our small town, with river bottom land behind our garage and a muddy, shallow creek bordering the south side. It was on these few acres of tough clay soil that the ball diamond was created, regulation size, with plywood boards resting on 5-gallon buckets for benches and bright-colored frisbees for bases. Beginning in May, and not letting up until it was time to go back to school, the diamond played host to weekly neighborhood contests between scads of boys and tomboys like me. Some were pickup games, but some were tournaments that resulted in the all-important bragging rights for the year. Under the hot summer sun, with horseflies buzzing around our heads, we chewed wads of bazooka bubblegum, taunted the batters, and pretended we were in the big leagues. As we grew older and were drawn in new directions, weeds took over the outfield and the once meticulous infield melded into the grass. But to this day, I cannot peer out the back window of my mom's house without envisioning that diamond and those boys, bats held high and dreams held higher. Editor's letter was written by Mary Beth Weisenberger, and we're going to turn to a baseball story titled My Nakona Glove. It's by Roger Elliott. Occasionally, I find myself thinking about the not-so-distant past and the fleeting days of my carefree, blissful youth. Reading this, some may scoff or admonish, you shouldn't think about the past. But I'd have to disagree. Some scholars have written that it's healthy to remember the good and bad times of our youth, and I agree with them. We have a tendency to magnify in our memories at least the enjoyable times of youth while minimizing the unpleasant. That's the way it is with me. Before World War II, my daddy played semi-pro baseball for his hometown team, the Griffin Pimentos. Pimento pepper was a principal crop in that section of rural Georgia during those pre-war days, hence the team's nickname. For our first Christmas in Oak Ridge, Daddy gave my brother Ronnie and me baseball gloves. Mine was a Nakona, the first baseball glove I had ever owned. I loved it. Following Daddy's instructions, I began creating a permanent pocket in my new glove using a baseball, oil, and elbow grease. Every few days, I'd pound a baseball into the pocket, after which I would rub the glove with oil. Then I'd place the ball inside the pocket and curl the glove's fingers around it, securing the cozy nest with a string to hold it shut and the ball in place. Finally, I printed my name in ink along the outside of the thumb and inside the wrist strap. Ronnie and I played sandlot baseball across the street from our house on the school's playground. At the end of our games one day, I was unable to locate my treasured glove. I questioned all my friends, but nobody had seen it. Several of us searched the playground until after dark. I was in a panic and heartbroken. How could I tell my daddy about the missing glove, and what would he say? After a week or more, a playground friend told me he knew the whereabouts of my Nakona glove. He gave me the name of an older boy who had a reputation of being a playground bully. That same evening, I told Daddy what I had heard. Almost immediately, he and I went to the playground hoping to find the alleged thief. Not seeing him, Daddy began to question several of the other boys. Soon one of them told us the boy had somehow got word that we were on our way to the playground and had fled with the glove. We were told the boy had hidden it inside the scout house, a small building just off the playground. Daddy and I made our way there to find it locked. Without much effort, Daddy pried the lock away, and we went inside. After a brief search, we found my glove. The boy had attempted to write his name over mine, but his efforts were unsuccessful. My name was still clearly visible. On our way home, we noticed the boy had returned to the playground. Daddy and I approached him. Confronted with his crime and the undeniable evidence I was holding, the boy began screaming, crying, and pitching a highly animated hissy fit, all the while loudly denying he had stolen my glove. He insisted the glove was his and had always been his. He threatened my daddy and told him he would be in trouble for breaking into the scout house and that his older brother would come looking for him. He ranted and raged like a caged animal. It frightened me, but my daddy only laughed. He told the boy, "We'll see about that." We never heard a word from anyone about the incident. I had my glove back, and after that, I was more careful when I took it to the playground. And for some reason, the boy who had taken my treasured glove never returned to the playground while I was there. Also, nothing ever came of Daddy breaking into the scout house, nor did we ever get to meet the boy's big brother. My Nakona Glove was written by Roger Elliott. And we're turning now to The Day I Became the Babe. It's written by Larry Bollowinder. I was born and raised in the Heights section of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, in the left half of a double-block house at the top of Brewery Hill, which overlooked the Stagmeyer Brewery. Every noon, the brewery would blow its whistle, and on crisp mornings, you could smell the hops brewing. Our house was on Dogger Lane, and at its end, it ran into Coal Street. Across that street was an abandoned coal mine field, but to us kids, that coal mine field comprised our baseball field. Glistening bits of coal marked the infield, and the outfield was backed up by two coal company buildings, which we called the shacks. It was Saturday morning in the late 1940s. I was 11 or 12 years old, and it was roundup time to play baseball. I would start going to the kids' houses to get them or wake them up to play. First, it was Tommy's house with his brother Paul. We had three. Then on to Chuck and Johnny's house, then Xavier and Butchie's place. And so it went until we got enough kids to make up two teams. We used old coverless baseballs that we taped up with bandage or electrical tape. Our bats were discarded baseball bats. We would nail up the cracks and splits and, guess what, add more tape to cover the nails. Talk about for the love of the game. Our bases were either rocks or pieces of cardboard. When we got home after a game and looked inside our socks, our feet would be black with coal dust. One Saturday, we all marched across Coal Street and lined up the bases, putting home base as far from the shacks as we could, because a home run was over the shacks unless it was inside the park. Given the balls and bats we used, it was a feat for a kid to put one over. It was time to play ball. During the early part of the game, I was on deck waiting to bat, swinging my bat back and forth. I glanced out to the left side of the field, and running up to us was Rose, the neighborhood beauty queen. "Hi, Larry," she greeted me as she caught her breath. "Hi, Rose," I replied. What a time to see this girl, but I dug deep for a way to impress her. "Rose, you want to see me hit one over the shacks?" I asked her coolly. "Oh, Larry, no one can hit a ball that far," she replied. "Stick around, Rose," I shot back. I came up to bat, and then I did it. Swinging my bat back and forth, I suddenly stopped and pointed my bat high once, then twice toward the shacks. I was calling my shot, just like Babe Ruth did in a World Series game when the Yankees played the Cubs in Chicago in 1932. Letting two balls go by, I got my pitch, crack, and the ball sailed into the sky. But would it make it over the shacks? Going, going, it was gone. As I rounded the bases, Rose was jumping up and down. "Larry, you did it. You did it," she yelled. Rounding third, I just nodded. My moment had come. Over the years, my wife and I have visited Wilkes-Barre many times. Sometimes we ride up to the heights to see the old homestead, and sometimes we'll walk down Donner Lane and walk along Coal Street. The old coal mine field is gone, the shacks are gone, and instead there is a beautiful park with tennis courts, benches, and street lamps. My thoughts go back to that old coal mine field. Even in the coal dust, playing with taped baseballs and nailed bats, those were beautiful days. Sometimes we'll walk up Coal Street, and I'll see the house where Rose lived, and I always smile. Rose, I wonder if she still lives there. I wonder if she remembers me. I wonder if she remembers the day I became the Babe. The Day I Became the Babe was written by Larry Balawenda. And let us turn now in the April 2012 issue of the Good Old Days magazine to Two Box Tops and 25 Cents. While visiting a local hobby shop, I discovered a time machine modestly priced at $2.99. The package proclaimed, "Amazing diving submarine, needs no batteries, hours of fun." And almost instantly, I was no longer standing in the hobby shop. Nope, I was whisked to the kitchen table of my boyhood home. I was 8 years old, and it was 1957. By 1947, the more than 19 million members of the post-war baby boom were hooked hooked on three things: Saturday morning TV westerns, scanning the heavens for flying saucers, and consuming mountains of sugar-coated breakfast cereal. Competition for our loyalty was fierce, so fierce, in fact, that every manufacturer promoted its products with mail-in offers for PT boats, diving Navy frogmen, submarines, and space rockets. Almost without exception, these vehicles relied on the carbon dioxide from baking powder as a propellant, which, as an unintended consequence, caused the sales of Calumet and Clabber Girl to skyrocket. The price of every offer was constant: two box tops and 25 cents, the idea being that the brand could capture your attention for at least two boxes worth of product while the marketing department cooked up another promotion. As a preview of coming attractions, miniature versions of future premiums were sometimes included with the cereal. One morning, while shoveling in another mouthful of Kellogg's Frosted Flakes, my gaze was riveted to the back of the box. In blazing color was a fully illustrated promotion: the diving submarine. It dives, resurfaces, and needs no batteries. Powered by harmless bacon powder. Great fun for everyone. Silent and deadly, the stealthy undersea craft, which looked to be 500 feet long, was headed to the depths of some secret mission, and I wanted one of my own. At the bottom of the offer was the disclaimer: allow 4 to 6 weeks for delivery. Without bothering to finish the cereal, I cut the order form off the back, snipped off the box top, dug into my box top hoard to complete the pair, and fished a quarter out of my dungarees. After filling out the form and taping the quarter to it, I slipped everything inside an envelope, grabbed a 3-cent stamp, and literally sprinted across the street to the mailbox. I raised the little red flag, and the wait began. At age 8, I was already a die-hard Frosted Flakes man, and the shelves in my room held at least one of every gizmo Kellogg's dreamed up. These purchases embodied financial sacrifice, as 25 cents equaled my weekly allowance. I tolerated the cost, but awaiting delivery frayed my patience to the breaking point. On the plus side, Mama never had to ask me to fetch the mail. On Saturdays, I'd be astride my swing, leaning against the mailbox post an hour before our mailman, Mr. Wilkins, arrived, as though my presence would somehow accelerate his movements. Funny thing was, however, my toy never arrived on a Saturday. It would always come during the week. I'd trudge home after enduring another endless lesson about the principal products of Bolivia. As I slogged into the kitchen, Mom would offhandedly announce, "Richie, you have some mail." "I do." And sure enough, a little box addressed to me would be resting on the counter. Without stopping to change, I began filling the bathtub, digging out the tin of Calumet, and grabbing the measuring spoons. I'd carefully pry off the conning tower, fill the cavity beneath it with 1/4 teaspoon of baking powder, reseal the top, and drop the sub into the tub, where it would immediately sink. After the baking powder began releasing CO2, a large bubble would emerge beneath the sub, forcing it to the surface. Once there, the sub would list slightly to one side, the bubble would escape, and the submarine would hobble back to the bottom. Yes, sir, just like it said on the box, hours of fun, and it was. After hours of diving beneath the Pacific, searching for the enemy fleet, or gliding silently below the polar ice cap, I'd have a fizzy, sputtering mess overflowing the Calumet can from water I invariably dribbled into the container. I'd quit playing and sheepishly return to the kitchen, where a scolding from my mother awaited. It never succeeded in deterring my efforts. Not that Mom held out much hope of that to begin with. It was merely the culmination of the bathtub baking powder routine, and I'll wager I was nearly 20 before the realization dawned that baking powder was sometimes employed in baking. 2 box tops and 25 cents was written by Rich Finzer. And let us turn now in the April 2012 issue of the Looking Back magazine to Around Town, a collection of letters from readers of the magazine. We're going to start with Mom and Spring Storms. It's written by Philip Wells. Some things are certain. One of those things is that during the spring season, there will be storms. In the Midwest, there will be severe storms, and some of those storms will include tornadoes. I am reminded of an experience my mother had about this time of year in 1947. We lived in an area just outside Alton, Illinois. It was her usual practice to be up and around preparing breakfast during the early morning hours. On this particular day, the weather had already been stormy. Mom was at the kitchen sink washing dishes from breakfast when a loud noise caused her to look up. When she looked, she saw a tornado on the ground heading toward the house. Her only reaction was one born of faith in God. It was too late to do anything else. She only had time to utter a brief prayer, "God protect us." At that moment, she saw the funnel cloud rise. It continued on the same path, but now it passed over our house with a great roar before coming down to the ground a short distance from the rear of the house and continuing on its devastating route. Its path of destruction continued for several miles. Before the tornado dissipated, the town of Fosterburg was hit. Several buildings were torn apart and lives were lost. Mother always was a woman of great faith in the power of prayer. Mom and Spring Storms was written by Philip Wells. This is by Doris Danner, Planting Pansies. When I was a young girl and living with my maternal grandmother, I was introduced to the beauty of flowers. Since we lived in a city apartment without front or back lawn, the outside planting of flowers was not available. However, we were fortunate to have a sizable back porch that we could step onto from our second floor dining room. At each corner, Grandma had placed a flower box atop the railing, along with several colorful flowers. These she tended daily with loving care. She often explained to me the names of each flower and whether it was an annual or perennial. I believe her favorite flower must have been the pansy, because she seemed to have an abundance of them in her flower pots. She would gently hold one of them between her fingers and explain that if you used your imagination, you could see a little smiling face looking up at you. Many times we sat in the hammock enjoying the fruits of her gardening. A gentle breeze would cause the pansies to dip their heads up and down. Then Grandma would say, "See their smiling faces as they nod good morning to you?" Over the years, I've always included pansies in a special box of my own. It brings back a flood of happy memories when I was young and Grandma encouraged me to see the beauty of even the simplest flower, especially the pansy with its smiling face. Planting Pansies was written by Doris Danner. And this is by Pat Lay Wilson, A Grandmother Remembers. Did you ever have a dirt clod fight when you were a kid? These fights always occurred the day after a warm spring rain, when all the neighborhood boys and girls would collect in a vacant lot and choose sides. It didn't matter who was older, who was younger, who was big, who was little. We were all the same under dirt clod rules. We would face off on opposite sides of the vacant lot, and then somebody would give a signal of some sort, and every one of us, boys and girls, would grab fistful of the slippery grass anchored in moist brown dirt. We flung the sodden dirt clods at the kids on the other side of the lot, sometimes hitting someone on the side of the head. But mostly, our clods landed in bursts of mud on the ground beside them. We would shake our heads, dodge incoming missiles, and lob them back to the opposition until suddenly somebody's mom would call somebody to dinner and the game would be over. We'd trudge back to our houses where fierce moms waited with folded arms. "What were you doing? Your hair is full of dirt." Mom would push us into the bath water growling, "Look at you. Your hair is filthy." And then she would grind our dirty scalps with her fingernails and make us ashamed of our antics. That is, until the next spring day, warm and mild, when the vacant lot full of dirt clods was just calling for a good fight. Then we would all gather and choose sides again. A Grandmother Remembers was written by Pat Lay Wilson. And with that, we're at the end of today's edition of The Good Old Days. I'm Jerome Manigan, inviting you to join me again next week, same place, same time, for another journey back in time to the good old days. Bye-bye. Was recorded in the studios of Radio Reading Services, WRRS, the voice of information by Mark D. Whitman.